We are in Cambridge. This is the Master's Lodge at Trinity College, Cambridge, and we're with Lucy Hawking.
Hello, Richard.
Who is a great writer of children's books about science in collaboration with your dad.
That's right. I've written two books, two out of the three so far. We've done George's Secret Key to the Universe, which is about how stars form and how they become black holes. And after that, we wrote George's Cosmic Treasure Hunt, which is fundamentally about the search for life in the universe. But it's also about the ways that we have travelled across the universe. How have we found out what we know? What have we used to further our knowledge of our cosmic neighbourhood?
So we talked about this when we did that panel together at Origins, ASU.
That was about a year ago.
Yeah, right. How soon do you think you can start hooking people into getting jazzed by science?
Well, when we started off writing this series, we started off thinking that 8 years old was the youngest that we would aim for. And I suppose my son was around that age at that time, and his friends were asking a lot of questions, specifically to my dad, say at my son's birthday parties. They were coming up to my dad and saying, "So, Stephen, tell me, what would happen if I fell in a black hole?" And so we could see that children of that age were interested. They knew about these concepts and they wanted a way to understand and process more information about them. But since we started writing the books, we get a lot of fan mail now. And actually, it's been interesting. A lot of the fan mail actually comes from parents of even younger children.
Yeah.
I mean, just recently I had a letter from the parents of a very gifted five-year-old saying, "My son loved these books because they give him information in a clear and accessible format. And he is very frustrated by the lack of information written for readers such as him. So I would say that some children can latch onto this much earlier.
Yeah. So do you remember what Stephen said when he was asked what happens when you fall into a black hole?
He gave a very clear and very explicit answer, which we then elaborated into a part in George's Secret Key to the Universe. And so what happened was that question became the inspiration actually for a whole chapter of the book, in which my father starts off by explaining how to make a black hole. So he gives you a sort of recipe, what you will need in order to create a black hole, then how to find it, and then what happens if you fall into it. And I think largely his advice would be not to panic, because you can get out again.
So I suppose it's appropriate that we're talking about this here in Cambridge.
In Cambridge, my father's been at Cambridge for over 40 years. In a sense, I was born in Cambridge in 1970. So I too have been here on and off for most of my life.
Oh, I've forgotten. Yes, you have a big birthday. So, but you're not going to be. I've just heard that you're actually not going to be here for this coming year.
I am.
We actually met at ASU in Origins, and you're going back there.
I am. I'm very lucky to have the opportunity to go to ASU in Arizona. I'm going to be the writer in residence at the Origins program from September. I'm on to the third children's book of the trilogy, and that's called George and the Big Bang, and that is about the origins of the universe. So it's an attempt to describe, through an adventure story, it's an attempt to describe the origins of the universe for our young readers. And it's an attempt to answer lots of the kind of questions that they've put to us about the Big Bang and about the early universe. So it's going to be a very exciting time for me, because I'll be at ASU in the Origins program and writing George and the Big Bang about the origins of the universe.
Yeah. So didn't you have some association while you were here with a television series I did some years ago was called The Human Quest, and one of the people I spoke to at some length was Simon Baron Cohen, who's now...
Simon is the professor of neuropathology at Cambridge University.
Involved in autism and
he's
so on
also
and so
the
forth.
Head of the Autism Research Centre at
Cambridge.
Weren't
you involved in that as well?
I have been involved in that. My involvement is more personal than scientific, in that my 12-year-old son is autistic.
Yeah.
And so obviously I have a vast amount of experience in what it's actually like to live with that as a condition. And it's very difficult. You know, on the one hand, there's this great search for answers. What is autism? What does it mean? Where does it come from? And then on the other hand, I see it from the point of view of a parent. Like, how can we best facilitate my son's potential? What conditions does he need? What education does he need that will give him the maximum chance of achieving what he can achieve? Because autism is an incredibly variable prognosis. Well, there isn't really a prognosis. There really is no way of knowing what might be achieved by the autist in question. And it's also something where you see an incredibly spiky profile. So you see perhaps potentially great achievements and then large areas of impairment at the same time. So I think it's a condition that scientists find fascinating because I think it is very interesting, and there's still, Simon might correct me, but there are no absolutely clear answers as to where it is and why it appears, and perhaps the huge growth in numbers diagnosed, certainly over the past decade. But then on the other hand, it's obviously a very challenging condition for families.
Does he give you, your son give you input on the way you're communicating science to young people?
My son is not yet at the stage. I can try things on him and see if they work.
Right.
Achieved the sufficient critical facility to give me absolute feedback. So it's more I get feedback by judging how he is understood. In fact, one project I have, which is very interesting, would be to go back and take the George series and rewrite it at a much simpler level, especially with a view to making this accessible to children with learning disabilities. Yeah. Because the thing is, I've given quite a lot of talks in special needs schools. So I've taught children with a variety of different developmental issues, and I've noticed that they all understand completely when I'm talking to them and showing them the images, and we're asking the questions, and it's an interactive process. They're absolutely fascinated. I mean, the whole concept of space and people floating and trying to eat a hamburger which is over there because you're in zero gravity, I get straight through to children who maybe it can be more challenging to hold their attention. And so I would like to go back and rewrite the whole series specifically with those children in mind.
Now, as I said, when I last saw you, you actually came out because Stephen at the time had a bug of some kind.
Yes, he had a pneumonia infection, and he was sort of stuck in California.
Apparently he's recovered again.
He is a lot better. He's here in Cambridge now, and he's making plans to go off to New York next week. He's going to the World Science Festival in New York, week on Monday. And yes, he has got a new TV series out where there's been a lot of publicity, especially in his comments about aliens. I don't necessarily agree with him, but I don't really. And he does appear to have made a full recovery.
Yeah.
Which is extraordinary. So if you're talking about medical and scientific oddities, then I think he would definitely fall into that category.
Did you get talked to much science when you were growing up?
I grew up with physicists everywhere. I mean, I did when I was a child. I didn't even it took me a long time to understand that when we went on holiday, we'd actually gone to a physics conference. I didn't realise that for years and years. I used to think, why have we always got the same people here? Everywhere we went on, it was lovely places. I mean, physicists are not stupid. They always pick nice places for their summer conferences. So we'd get there and it would always be the same. It'd be the same people. There'd be a nice hotel, there'd be a beach, and there'd be a lecture hall. And I just thought this was totally normal. It took me a long time to understand that this didn't happen on other people's family holidays.
Yeah. Were you ever inclined to sort of try and do some science yourself?
I mean, well, I think it was very clear for me. I think in a sense I was lucky that from a very early age it was clear that I was going off onto a creative and arts-based route, that was where my interests and my abilities lay. I mean, right from sort of the age of 3 or 4, I wrote my own stories and drew pictures of my own fantasy worlds and did a lot of dance and drama and singing and produced my own little radio show when I was about 8. Yeah. So I don't think there was really any question in anybody's minds that I would do anything other than go into a creative, work in the creative arts-based world. Yeah. I never felt particularly the urge to be a scientist, and in a way I suppose I'm grateful for that because I think it would have been a hard act to follow.
Yeah, but the importance of science. I mean, you've got some larger views on this as well. I mean, one of the questions I ask people a lot, especially since we're sitting in here, which is the Master of Trinity, of course, is Martin Rees, Lord Rees. He's also president of the Royal Society this year, for the end of his 5-year term. This is the 350th anniversary year of the foundation of the Royal Society, which is this superb long-running institution which brings together a community of scholars to look at ways to improve improve human understanding. And I also put into the context there the comment made by President Obama when he started his administration, and he talked about restoring science to its rightful place. So, you know, given this context, given the society we live in, and given your close ties to all of this, do you have any thoughts about the rightful place of science is?
Well, it's interesting that you mention Martin Rees, because of course he's one of the great communicators of science. I mean, he's a fantastic advocate for science. He's an incredibly intelligent, humane man who can put science and the advances in research into context for most lay people. I mean, most sort of non-scientists can relate entirely to the way Martin explains things, because he has great clarity and he has great vision, and also he has great empathy and compassion. And I think that increasingly this is what we're seeing. Science moving away from this idea that it's a completely separate activity, that most people would not be involved in it, that somehow it's extremely exclusive and incomprehensible. And I think one of the great advances in, say, even in the past decade, or in the past decade, is that scientists have made this massive effort to communicate, to be accessible, and to explain what their research is about and how this could benefit people, that there's a point to it. I mean, my father always says, well, his research is publicly funded. You know, he is a university professor. And so he feels that he has a duty to explain to people what he's doing. I mean, obviously, he is another example of someone who's a very good communicator, who has a great passion and a talent for explaining complicated concepts in simple terms. But he also feels it's a duty that he has as a scientist. One thing that I found interesting, I was given a book which was made up of drawings done by children. They were all asked to imagine a scientist and do a drawing of him. And a lot of them did draw a person with a very large head wearing a white coat by themselves. And one of the things we've tried to do with these books is to show science as a collaborative process, that it's something where people work together, where people exchange views, and it's enormously engaging and entertaining. Yeah. That it's not
the mad scientist.
It's not the mad scientist, it's not the evil scientist, it's not the inhumane, crazy person plotting the demise of humanity. It's actually a collaborative effort on the part of enormous numbers of people to try and further our understanding of ourselves, of our planet, where we come from, and how we can make life better for a large number of people. So that, I think, is important.
Although it must be said that some of them really were odd. I mean, I tend to ask a lot of questions of scientists, ask them if they had if I gave them a time travel token and they could invite anybody in for dinner, who would they have?
And
Martin,
who did they say?
Martin particularly, and Sean Carroll, I think, in the same conversation almost said, well, not Newton. That would have been a nightmare.
I think Newton, there was a play done in Trinity College recently, which was all based on Newton's writings. And I think we all came away staggered by really quite how odd he was. It was the thing about stabbing himself in the eye for an experiment that, oh, that was where he lost me there.
Yeah. So if you had it, I'll give you the token. Which scientists would you like to meet from, or other people from history? Or?
Oh, who would I bring back from my... Well, I would love to meet Charles Darwin.
Yeah.
I mean, would that not be a fascinating conversation? I mean, if from any point of view, he would be probably one of the most interesting people that you could have to dinner. Although I gather that the Darwin family were quite neurotic about their health, but my family are as well, so I'm sure he'd fit in perfectly with the Hawkings. Equally, I would love to have one of the earlier scientists, maybe Galileo.
Yeah.
And that again would be an equally fascinating discussion as to how did he come up, how did he came up. So he was totally revolutionary, and yet he was also extremely penalised for sticking to his point of view. So that would be an interesting person. I always think that you couldn't go wrong with Elizabeth I as a dinner guest. I mean, perhaps she might have quite high standards for what you offered her to eat. So I don't know, how do you think it's working out so far? It's How's fine. My placement going?
I certainly think it'd be interesting to have Galileo sitting there. I think your father would enjoy talking to
I think he Galileo. Would, and then I suppose you could add Leonardo da Vinci to the mix. Yeah. Have I got too many big hitters now? No, I so. Think the small talk's going to falter.
You go back and forth between the States and here quite a bit anyway.
I do. Sometimes I've been at home because I've been writing for the past year, so I've been mostly here in Cambridge.
Right.
Although obviously my son and I will be going, both going together in September to Arizona, right. We hope.
Do you sense any major difference in the scientific communities?
I think there's always a sort of certain vibrancy in the USA. And there's a lot of optimism there, especially now with Obama as president. I feel that there seems to be a renaissance, or a sort of renewed energy. Yeah. Over what's happening in the USA, whereas here, obviously, Europe is in a somewhat confused and chaotic state at the moment.
Yeah, the state of science in this country, it's hard to tell.
I'm not sure that that's something I would feel totally confident in commenting on, because I don't really feel it's sort of up to me. I am, after all, just a storyteller intending to impart the work of scientists to a young audience, so that that young audience could possibly engage with a subject matter that otherwise they might feel didn't relate to them.
Yeah.
So I, as I said, I always like to remind myself I am just a humble storyteller.
So when we were there last time, we had Neil Tyson there as well.
Yes, who I've seen since in Cambridge, actually. He came here for the Cosmos Award from the Planetary Society.
Great. And Andrea, and we were talking about the state of science communication at one point. And I just talking to a couple of other scientists about this as well, about the fact that, first of all, a lot of newspapers have cut back on their science departments. So there's been a short decrease in the number of people professionally qualified to dispense information about science to a general audience. And there's also a much tighter market in science, in the sense that grants are dwindling. So to receive money, you have to make an extremely good case for why your stuff should be funded, which often leads you to engage the media to perhaps make your case for you. Do you have any sense at all, since you are in the writerly part of this, of a diminishing in the standards of communication of science?
Well, I mean, the first thing I would say is that newspapers have cut across the board, that there have been massive cutbacks in terms of journal. I have a lot of friends who are journalists, and I think that the cuts have happened in every field. So I don't think science is being necessarily penalised in newspaper terms, but the advent of the internet, the rise of 24-hour news has had a dramatic impact on revenues for newspapers, and a lot of them are struggling. And I think it gets more and more difficult for them to maintain a large and specialist staff. So a lot of work it goes out to freelancers now. I do feel that there are specialist publications like New Scientist, like Scientific American, which are very good. I also think there's been a massive increase in science broadcasting for a popular audience,
right.
Maybe not specialist, but certainly at the level that I'm working in and accessing, I think there are more, certainly in the UK, there are more BBC and independent production programmes, both on television and radio, about science for a popular audience than there's ever been before.
You know, you mentioned that you, when you were 8, you were doing little plays and broadcasts and so on. Have you thought of doing a play?
Doing a play of the children's books, or doing a play in general?
Just doing a general play.
Yes, I have. I think, like everyone, I have a lot of ideas, but I'm limited by time as to what I can actually... And obviously, I am also a single mother of an autistic child, so it's the frustration of not there not being enough hours in the day. And there is a story that I like about my father, which is... when he'd been diagnosed with this illness and he thought maybe he didn't have very long to live, he tried to rearrange his life so that he would have more hours in the day. So he didn't want to live on a 24-hour clock, so he changed it because he thought he wasted too much time getting up and going to sleep. And he thought he could minimise this by living on a different So maybe it was 36 hours or 48 hours or 72 hours, whatever he thought he would do. So he did it and he stuck to it rigidly for really quite a long time, but apparently he became absolutely unbearable. And eventually he had to admit that no, the 24-hour cycle applied even to him, and went back to it. So I would counsel people against trying to seek more hours in a day than there really are.
Yeah, all right. Well, look, I've got to go and do a conversation now with the occupant of this building, Martin Rees.
The very distinguished occupant of this wonderful building.
But it was great for you to drop in. Let's pick it up when you get back out to the States.
Fantastic, thank you.
Because we'll be back over at ASU as well.
Wonderful, I shall see you there.